Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I am always grateful that each week we're able to get a briefing on, well, the war for the free world and its various component parts by one of the most intelligent people I know, Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, blogger par excellence at dianawest.net. I'm the author of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings, among other places, at the Daily Caller, as well as dianawest.net. Diana, welcome back. So good to have you.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back.
Well, as a serious monitor of what is going on within our culture and society more generally, Diana, I wanted to get your take on Mark Zuckerberg's appearance yesterday before two committees meeting jointly in the Senate. As we speak, he is preparing to have another go at it in the House Energy and Commerce Committee. But from what we've seen to date, what do you make in particular of all senators, I guess, apart from Ted Cruz, really, seeming much concerned about the role Facebook and internet giants like it are playing in censoring our intellectual content on their platforms?
Yes, well, this is really, in a way, the death of the grown-up, the death of democracy, the death of Americanism, writ very large in this abdication. It's a very serious, extremely serious moment where we watch essentially citizenship participation in the public square, which has become a social media square in many ways for so many people, be turned over to the censors of Facebook, to the vacuum cleaners of Facebook that taking up all of our personal data and using it in various nefarious ways, and then watching the senators largely capitulate to this. As far as Senator Cruz went, you know, I was very encouraged to see him discussing the censorship of conservatives, prominently Diamond and Silk, black women who support Donald Trump, whose Facebook page was deemed a threat to the community. This is an incredible moment. I was sorry he didn't drill down a bit more on this.
Well, he only had 4 minutes.
In terms of turning, it's not a matter of how many conservatives work at Facebook. It is their policy. It is the policy to censor conservatives. That is the measure here. And we've already gotten there. We're not heading there. We've gotten there.
That's the thing that's so troubling, is that it does seem as though this is more or less a fait accompli, as they say. And I wonder, Dan, again, as a student of what we think and are doing, let me ask you, it occurs to me that if we are as cavalier about the wholesale invasion of our privacy, is it really any wonder that many of us, at least, are seemingly so sanguine or even indifferent about invasions of our ability to express ourselves, freedom of speech, or for that matter, the freedom to bear arms or other constitutional rights?
Absolutely. It's an infantilizing process. And I would take it back to the sexual revolution as a way of showing the breakdown in reticence, in discretion, in privacy, when we were taught that all kinds of human interaction, previously behind screens and all the rest of it, were public issues, were topics to be spread all over the newspapers, in front of cameras and everything else. And this now we have several generations, multiple generations, raised with no sense of privacy, no sense of restraint, even in discussion and everything else in terms of exchanges of information on these very most private kinds of behaviors in terms of the development of the human being.
Let me pivot just a bit, because, you know, this point about infantilization and the fundamental transformation, if you will, of our society. You've also used the term Marxian destruction and pointed out that, among others, conservatives seem to be awfully, I don't know if sanguine is the right term for it, but compliant But how is that? And what role does the lingering legacy of McCarthyism play, as you said?
Well, it is essentially a testament to, if that's the right word, a marker of the extent to which we are, one, all creatures of our time, and two, our entire society across the political spectrum has been taken down, has been destroyed from within by the vectors of Marx. Sometimes I call them Marxian, in terms of fundamental transformation. I mean, this is something we just can't get away with. This didn't just happen to the left, it happened to the right. It didn't just happen to the Democrats, it happened to the Republicans. And this is something that I'm afraid most people are not open to or don't want to delve into, because it's a difficult subject, and for some reason it has been essentially a black spot, an unknown place for people to really start to understand how we could be where we are. But it is a universal transformation and across the board. And of course, if we go back over the history of the past century, we do see these vectors coming out of the efforts to get to one world global communism. And of course, the headquarters for that have been Moscow. And this is where we get to a very important area of research and understanding so that we can connect it to the problems we have today, both culturally, the loss of privacy, the loss of citizenship, I would say, that goes along with that, and politically. So it's a very, very big problem, and the complexities should not dissuade us. This is important to delve into.
It is indeed. And the trouble is that, unfortunately, especially to the extent that we're relying on so-called news purveyors, news sources like Facebook to help us be cognizant of these sorts of choices or changes, they're part of the problem, as we were talking about a moment ago. And we're that much more, I'm afraid, in their thrall if we ignore that.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a fact that there is a concept in the development of KGB information operations that has to do with, I believe the term is reflexive action, reflexive procedures that essentially control the information flow so that the object of this operation essentially comes to the right decisions based on the information that the enemy has essentially controlled. So this becomes, if you look at Facebook in terms of its censoring of conservatism, etc., they are certainly operating along these very classic lines of information operation to essentially allow people to come to the correct, quote-unquote, decision based on the information that they are controlling. And this is where censorship is so terribly dangerous. And Facebook, of course, it is writ large and increasingly larger. So I'm hoping that there is some way to cut down their power or certainly recategorize them, not as a neutral provider, as Senator Cruz was trying to get at, but as a censor/publisher.
Well, they need to be so identified, and it seems to me they need to be, as you say, Diana West, broken up. Diana, we have to leave it at that for this particular segment. We will come back to you next week and look forward to doing so. Thank you for the great work you do at DianaWest.net, and please check out her brand new audio book version of the splendid American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Bless you, my dear. Come back to us soon. Next up, Tom Fitton joins us, the extraordinary leader of an incalculably important organization, Judicial Watch, on the Mueller probe, the Clinton scandals, George Soros, and more, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by the, well, simply irreplaceable Tom Fitton, the president of Judicial Watch, by my money, one of, if not the most important public policy organizations in Washington, D.C. these days. It describes itself as a watchdog. It is indeed performing that role, but to a degree that the United States Congress is not. It is really providing an incalculably important oversight function, holding accountable elected and appointed officials in a way that virtually no one else is doing. It is a delight to have its president, Tom Fitton, the author of The Corruption Chronicles, Obama's Big Secrecy, Big Corruption, and Big Government, and Clean House, Exposing Our Government Secrets and Lies. With us, Tom, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you, my friend.
Frank, good to be with you. Thanks for having me, Nate. Thanks for the intro.
Well, listen, you've earned it and more. Let me ask you, Tom, to sort of introduce a multifaceted topic with us. When we think about the current parlous state of our republic, it is pretty obvious that a number of the forces at work have been unleashed years ago. And I'm particularly interested in both your corporate memory as well as your investigative work on the role of the Obama and Clinton teams in Benghazi, for example, and in overthrowing friendly, if authoritarian, governments in the Middle East, and the contribution that's made to so much of what seems to be afflicting American interests, not just in that region, but here at home as well.
Well, we're at war in Syria today, thanks to Obama and Hillary Clinton. There's no doubt about it. You know, we had been investigating the attack on our consulate or our special mission in Benghazi, and we uncovered documents showing the Obama administration knew about arms transfers from Benghazi to Syria, specifically knew about the nature of the conflict in Syria that was coming, which was that the West, including the United States, was supporting the terrorist entities that were, quote, the rebels in Syria.
Including Al-Qaeda, as I recall.
That's right, Al-Qaeda. And there was warnings about the emergent ISIS movement in the border region between Syria and Iraq, because the government recognized at the time, when you had the Syrian government forces pull back from the border and the Iraqi forces pull back from the border as a result of the ensuing the conflict that was then emerging, that someone else would step in. The ISIS effort and the caliphate goal was really reinvigorated. And all of that was warned about in this DIA document that Judicial Watch discovered 3 years ago, Frank, that showed the Obama administration knew everything that could and was going wrong in Syria, but doubled down on. As I said, they knew the weapons were going in from Benghazi to Syria in such a way that they could count which weapon type was going out, which meant they had an inside source.
Or for actually facilitating it, is my guess, Tom Fitton. Yeah, one of the things that I think you haven't yet gotten your hands on, alas, but that we really need to see is Presidential Study Directive 11, I believe it's called, which was essentially the mandate from President Obama for the overthrow of these governments, not just in Libya, but in Egypt and Tunisia and for that matter, I think, in Syria. Have you been trying to get your hands on that, Tom? And how important do you think that document might be as kind of a Rosetta Stone on the policy hash-up that they made?
I don't know if we have a specific Freedom of Information Act request for that, but it occurs to me as you describe it that the DIA report, to the degree it's echoed in these other directives and other briefings the president was getting, it's going to make the Obama administration look unbelievably reckless in its handling of the Syria situation.
Malfeasant comes to mind. And as we're talking about the Clinton team, let me just ask you to broaden the lens here to the domestic as well. You cover this really magnificently at Judicial Watch. The Mueller probe, you have written, is out of control. And as it's playing out, some of the people who have been intimately involved with Mueller over the years are once again in the news. Jim Comey, the former director of the FBI, is about to start a book tour. Loretta Lynch, the former attorney general to President Obama and overseer of the FBI, such as she was during the day, is out doing her own, but seems like damage control. What do you anticipate is going to be sort of the leitmotif of Comey's book? And will there be new insights into the conflicts of interests that all of these characters have, notably Bob Mueller?
Comey will, I think, throw spears at everybody. He's already criticized Attorney General Lynch and the Justice Department, of course, ignoring the FBI's own politicization. And it's being reported today he compares Donald Trump to a mob boss. So it's going to be ugly. President Trump was right to fire Mr. Comey, and the whole Mueller investigation is tainted as a result of Comey's involvement in its creation. Because recall, Frank, Comey admitted that he took documents and leaked them in order to get the special counsel appointed. And, you know, crimes resulting in the appointment of a special counsel, it usually means because the special counsel has to figure out what the crime is or investigate crime, it doesn't mean the crime caused the appointment, meaning it was the basis of his appointment. It's an unbelievable situation.
Yeah, and a new document that seems to have been developed to cover certain behinds involving the Manafort prosecution has just come to light as well. And it seems, Tom, almost everywhere you look, and thank God you are looking everywhere you can, there's evidence of misconduct, of either just plain old-fashioned corruption or malfeasance, as we said. And one example of which was speaking of Loretta Lynch, her meeting with Bill Clinton. That story keeps on developing as well. What are you finding there?
Well, you know, what's outrageous about that, and everyone knows about that tarmac meeting, is that the Justice Department created a series of talking points. You know, supposedly it was just a meeting about grandkids. It's a coincidental, but they had two pages of talking points. They've all been blacked out by this Justice Department. And that's the problem we're facing, is that you had all of these issues emerge during the Obama administration with the politicization and the bias and corruption of the Justice Department and FBI with respect to the Clinton administration, with Clinton email. And it continued with the Trump targeting. And all of that's being protected by this Justice Department and FBI. It's incredible to see them bending over backwards to protect Clinton and allow those who want to target Trump illicitly to go forward without much accountability.
And what's up with that, Tom? I mean, is this that the Justice Department is still largely populated by Obama holdovers or leadership failings on the part of Trump personnel? What's your assessment?
I just don't think there's this interest in the corruption issues that the voters have, and they don't think accountability is important. I don't know how else to describe it. It's been well over a year, and look, there's more than enough evidence to arrest Hillary Clinton. Just late last year, we found that we uncovered the nature of the classified information on Anthony Weiner's laptop. This classified information was on Hillary Clinton's email server. It got on Weiner's laptop through her aide, Yuma Abedin, who also had an email account on the server, and it included the identity of a CIA official. You know, that type of classified information and mishandling classified information would have resulted in the arrest of anyone else.
And speaking of Yuma Abedin, who I have long regarded as a very problematic right-hand woman to Hillary Clinton, Tom Fitton, what you have uncovered through your Freedom of Information Act efforts and related lawsuits and so on indicates a pattern of misconduct with respect to the handling of classified information and other procedures of the State Department that would also be the sort of thing that warrants prosecution. What's your reading on her status and the extent of her exposure?
Well, that's a good point, because it's not just Hillary Clinton who faces potential liability. It's Yuma Abedin. You've got the classified information on her accounts that were not government accounts, just as Hillary Clinton had classified information on her accounts. Everything you hear about Hillary Clinton in terms of classified mishandling applies to Yuma Abedin and maybe others in the State Department. And on top of that, you also had her being the kind of the go-between with the Clinton Foundation in terms of the pay-to-play situation, where Clinton Foundation donors were getting special favors from the State Department, and Ms. Abedin was right in the center of that.
Right. Some of them, like this Skolkovo saga, are very, very high-order national security concern. Let me ask you finally, Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch, about another story that I know you all have been trying to track. It's not gotten anything like the attention that it seems to me it deserves, apart from your good efforts, namely this seeming Pakistani ring, perhaps attached to the ISI, the Intelligence Services of Pakistan, that operated and to some extent seems perhaps still to be tied into numbers of Democratic members of the House of Representatives, the so-called Awan Brothers IT scandal. What's your latest reading on that, Tom?
Well, I'm just interested that the House and the House isn't terribly interested in figuring out what went on with that scandal. It was a case of a gang, really, a family and close associates who had the in on IT support services for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who at the time was head of the DNC, and basically 40 members of the Democratic caucus in the House, including members of the Intelligence Committee. And they were running a racket out of the house. And, you know, the open question is, was it just a gang, a normal criminal gang that was taking money that didn't belong to them in terms of not providing services and getting paid for services that weren't provided, stealing data, stealing equipment, hacking systems? Were they just messing around because they were criminals? Or was there something more nefarious, as you point out, the Pakistan connection? At one point, the IT support for these folks were being run out of Pakistan by one of these Awad brothers. And despite the criminality that they were alleged to have engaged in, the ringleader was allowed to remain in the house for a period of time because Debbie Wasserman Schultz, by her own admission, was concerned that he was being targeted because he was Muslim.
This is a story that we need to continue plumbing, and we look forward to doing so with you and the help of your terrific team at Judicial Watch, including our friend Chris Farrell. Thank you so much, Tom Fitton, for joining us today. Keep up that good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Robert Spencer joins us next. We'll talk about Mike Pompeo's nomination and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by the simply incredible Robert Spencer, a man who has studied deeply and written expansively on matters involving what I consider to be the single most serious threat we are facing today, and that arises from what I consider to be the best way of describing it, Sharia supremacism. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the director of Jihad Watch, the author of some 15 books. He has a new one just about to arrive. In fact, you can order it right now, entitled The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS. He also, among his other terrific works, is the man behind The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran. And there are a lot of infidels who need to understand what's going on with that, including a woman by the name of Laurie Goodstein at the New York Times. Robert, I was very pleased to see that you did a very effective and prompt rebuttal to a piece that she had in the Times over the past couple of days, characterizing, or really mischaracterizing, Mike Pompeo, the candidate for the Office of Secretary of State, who will have his hearing tomorrow in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Walk us through a little bit what Ms. Goodstein and others like her are saying about Mike Pompeo and your rejoinder to her.
Well, you know, Frank, I think that Laurie Goodstein's article is part of the ongoing effort to prevent President Trump from implementing the policies that he said he was going to implement as he was running for president. So in other words, they're trying to keep him from doing what got him elected. And in this case, you have the president all the summer of the campaign rebuking Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for not daring to say radical Islamic terrorism. In other words, not being willing to acknowledge the motivating ideology that's behind the global jihad threat. And it seemed clear that the president was determined to bring back what Barack Obama banished, a realistic analysis of this, of the nature and magnitude of the threat. And so now we see the same thing yet again. The article that Laurie Goodstein wrote is entitled Pompeo and Bolton Appointments Raise Alarm Over Ties to Anti-Islam Groups. And of course, that's us, Frank. But she excoriates Mike Pompeo in particular for saying that particular terrorist attacks have to do with Islam and acts as if this is some sort of a preposterous idea, when in the first place, it's completely in line with what the president has said. And also any objective observer and analyst of the Quran and of Islamic tradition will see that there is plenty that jihadis can use to incite Muslims to violence.
Yeah. Can and do use, let the record show, of course. And this is why your new book is going to be so helpful, I know, Robert Spencer, in terms of helping to chronicle how throughout its history, this ideology the president refers to as Sharia has animated jihadism. So to think otherwise is really irresponsible, it seems to me, particularly among religion correspondent. So, Robert, you went through this article and I know spoke quite authoritatively about Sharia, also about this idea that it's somehow, you know, complete fabrication and nonsense to recognize that among the kinds of jihad that is being waged against the West these days is something the Muslim Brotherhood has called the civilization jihad. Talk a little bit about that, Robert, and the evidence that that is in the mix as well, including here in this country, a point on which I think Mike Pompeo and, for that matter, John Bolton, the new National Security Advisor, are quite clear.
Yeah, it's really kind of ridiculous, Frank, because Lori Goodstein says that Muslims in the United States have no intention. She says imposing Sharia law is not on their agenda, which is a sweeping, broad, and flat statement to make when there are quite a few Muslim organizations in the country, and some of them may well have this agenda in light of the fact that many of them are named in this extraordinary revealing Muslim Brotherhood document, the famous explanatory memorandum that delineates the civilization jihad. Neither I nor you wrote it. It was a Muslim Brotherhood document written by a senior member of the Brotherhood and explaining that the goal in America was, as they say in the document, in its exact words, eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house. When you have a document saying such a subversive thing, yeah, exactly, and then naming the major Muslim organizations in the United States as being on board with this effort, that's something that no responsible journalist would ignore.
Yeah. It's unclear whether, of course, we're dealing with responsible journalists, but it does seem as though they have, at the very least, a duty to know about things like this explanatory memorandum, which is, as you know, Robert Spencer, was introduced into evidence by the federal government in the Holy Land Foundation trial. So it has, you know, the advantage of being quite authoritative. Robert, one other piece of this, which I'm very concerned about and think, again, demands people of the caliber of John Bolton and Mike Pompeo to help the president implement his policies with respect to global jihad, among other things, is the emergence of Turkey as a very serious and quite malevolent force, not just in Syria or elsewhere in the Middle East, for that matter, but here inside the United States as well. What can you tell me about that?
Turkey is stepping up its financing of mosques in the United States and building, of course, most notably, that gigantic mega mosque in Maryland, and also mosques all over the country. And in light of the fact that Erdogan, the president of Turkey, is speaking quite openly and repeatedly about the glories of the Ottoman period, about the necessity for Turkey to reclaim the land that it once controlled, which would mean that he has his eyes on the Holy Land, on North Africa, Egypt. He's talking about restoring the Ottoman Empire. And this is not just idle boasting or braggadocio in light of the fact that he's got his military on the move against the Kurds in Syria right now. And there are indications that he is wanting to claim territory in Syria and Iraq. This is all part of this neo-Ottoman adventure that he is quite clearly embarked upon. Now, in light of that, when you have Turkish-financed mosques in the United States, then it has to be asked whether they are also on board with this effort and whether they will be spreading jihad ideology around the country from their mosque.
Yeah. Would you just say a word about that again as a serious scholar of the history of Sharia supremacism and Islam? What role have mosques historically played, and is there any reason to believe that at least many of them are doing the same in this moment?
Well, you know, it's not accidental that most mosques in the United States are called Islamic Center of this or that. That's not a benign term, because as the explanatory memorandum explains, and as is clear from history, the mosque is the center of operations. It's the base. Remember also that Al-Qaeda means the base. And the base of operations for the jihad is the mosque. It's where the jihadis get their ideological training, and where we have seen in many parts of the world, although we have not seen this in America, and I hope we never do, where weapons are stockpiled and where the attack often begins from. This is something that is abundantly clear throughout history. It's also noteworthy that after a victorious jihad conquest, the first item on the agenda for the conquerors, and we see this in history again and again and again, is to go into the most notable house of worship of the conquered infidels and make it into a mosque. And so we see the Hagia Sophia, which was once a great cathedral in Istanbul, and of course is now it was made into a mosque and was a mosque for hundreds of years, and then it was made into a museum by the secular Turks, and Erdogan wants to make it into a mosque again. And there are many other mosques throughout the Islamic world that used to be synagogues, churches, Hindu temples.
Yeah, and other sacred spaces, including the Ground Zero Mosque, would, I think, fall into this same model. Lastly, and very quickly, Robert Spencer, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, as we were talking about with Dinah West earlier, was on Capitol Hill yesterday. As we speak, he's going up again on the House side. Little interest, other than notably from Senator Ted Cruz, was expressed about the phenomenon of censorship by Facebook. You've had some hard experience of this yourself. Tell us quickly about it and why we should all be concerned about what Facebook and these other IT giants are up to in that regard.
Yeah, well, you know, it's becoming more widely known that Facebook is using its various complicated algorithms to clamp down on conservative sites. My site, Jihad Watch, last year lost 90% on one day, 90% of its referrals from Facebook, and has never recovered. They're choking off our platforms. And it's noteworthy that Facebook's Vice President Joel Kaplan traveled to Pakistan in July 2017 and assured the Pakistani government that it would remove material that the Pakistanis deemed anti-Islam. So what we've got is, in effect, the enforcement of Sharia blasphemy laws by Facebook.
Yeah. And it's not just the Pakistanis, by the way. As you know, it's also the European Union, which has succumbed to the same kind of pressure and is now having its edicts enforced by these IT operations. I think it's time to break them up. It's great to talk with you. Robert Spencer, thank you so much for all you do at jihadwatch.org. This is an indispensable resource. I hope everyone listening will make it part of their daily diet, as I do, and get those numbers back up where they belong. Robert, thank you, and we look forward with great expectation to the new book about the history of jihad, Muhammad, from Muhammad to ISIS. Come back to us again soon, if you will, sir. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk about Xi Jinping's latest and perhaps Paul Ryan's departure, among other things, right after this.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our visit with Gordon Chang, truly one of the high points of each week's broadcast here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is our duty expert and that of The Daily Beast and Fox News and so many other outlets for matters involving Asia and our interests, particularly security, but economic and geostrategic as well, in that very important part of the world. Gordon is the author of two incredibly important books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it is always a delight to have you. Welcome back, sir.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
Well, we've just gotten news as we're speaking that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, is going to be resigning. I'm not entirely clear as we're talking whether that's at the end of this year or more immediately, but at the very least he will now be a lame duck, as they say. I know domestic politics is not your area of expertise, Gordon, but it is noteworthy, among other reasons, because I think he was one of those who was very forcefully opposed to what President Trump is trying to do with his tariffs and otherwise threats, as Paul Ryan would see it, to his preferred policy approach of free trade. Any thoughts on his departure, or more broadly, what we're likely to see as a result of this champion of free trade departing the scene?
Yeah, as you say, the speaker has really been a free trade advocate, and he's certainly been against tariffs. What President Trump is trying to do with tariffs is certainly protect American innovation from predatory Chinese trade practices. Yes, no one likes tariffs, but unfortunately, nothing else has worked to stop the Chinese. And we're seeing President Trump's threats actually start to have an effect. Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, in a speech at the Boao Forum in Hainan Island in China, seemed to strike an extremely conciliatory pose that was unexpected. And that certainly is in response to our president's resolute points, not only about tariffs, but also on investment curbs on Chinese acquisitions in the startup tech area.
But is it, in fact, a pose, a posture, a Potemkin exercise meant to sort of allay concerns and position the Chinese as on the side of free trade and, you know, responsible trade relationships and so on, when in fact it's unlikely that he will follow through on those sorts of commitments?
Xi made a number of commitments. Some of them I think he actually will go forward with. Some of them he definitely won't. So, for instance, he did say that there would be some opening in the financial sector in China by the end of this year. Since he put a time frame on it, I'm sure that will occur. I'm also sure that there's going to be some reduction on China's tariffs on completed automobiles. The pledge that Xi Jinping made, which clearly will not be honored, is to protect the intellectual property of foreign companies, such as those from the United States. When we look at this whole issue, though, Frank, I look less at what Xi Jinping wants, because we know that he's a trade criminal, but we do look at what President Trump will do. And what Trump has done, I think, is very important in the sense that he has shown the Chinese that he, first of all, understands America's overwhelming leverage over China, but he's also willing to use it. And that is not a combination that we have seen for at least four decades, maybe even going back to the Eisenhower years. So this is important for the United States because it does mark a critical turn in the way the American president treats China and how he views China.
Gordon, one of the things that we touch on most weeks is what the Chinese are doing to push back. And obviously, one piece of this has been threatening retaliatory tariffs. There are indications that they're moving forward now rather more aggressively on trying to supplant the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. There's also, of course, aggressive efforts being made by the Chinese, as you pointed out in a recent piece in the Daily Beast, to be fighting us, competing may be the technical term for it, but I think fighting is a more accurate way of describing it, for domination of key technology sectors. And among them, I think, is quantum computing, as we talked about with Kevin Freeman yesterday, artificial intelligence, the 5G communication systems, hypersonic missiles, for example, as well. Talk about those competitions and the stakes as you see them.
There are four areas that I focus on. The most immediate is 5G wireless communications. 5G offers speeds 50 to 100 times faster than the current fourth generation networks. Qualcomm, the San Diego-based company, is certainly a competitor in 5G and indeed has superior technology. It's competing against Huawei Technologies, the supposedly employee-owned Chinese company, but really one with strong links to the People's Liberation Army and indeed the Chinese central government and Communist Party. And so when we talk about Qualcomm competing, it's not against Huawei. It's really against the Chinese central government, and this certainly is unfair. Also, China's putting enormous resources into artificial intelligence and, of course, quantum communications, where the Chinese have 2.5 to 5 year lead on us, and quantum computing. These are technologies that will, I think, guide the third, fourth, and fifth decades of this century. And so we've got to make sure that American companies compete and that they are supported by the U.S. government.
You know, some data that I discussed with Kevin yesterday, Gordon, really makes that point very powerfully, and that is that there is an estimate that the Chinese government is investing something like $10 billion in a facility for the purpose of really dominating the quantum computing technologies, and that the comparable level of investment by the U.S. government, which doesn't take into account private companies, of course, but still, apples to apples, is only about $200 million. And is that something that should be of concern? And is what you would recommend something along the lines of a kind of industrial policy for the United States government in these areas to try to give our private sector more of a fighting chance?
Oh, we definitely need an industrial policy, Frank, and we need so much more support for basic research in this country. What we also need to do is to allow U.S. companies to engage in what would otherwise be anti-competitive practices if they do that abroad with minimal effects in the United States. And the reason is that Chinese companies operate without worries about the anti-monopoly law in China. Matter of fact, Beijing uses that as a club against foreign companies, while at the same time, and this really is hideous, it consolidates already gargantuan state enterprises back into monopolies and near monopolies. I remember my dad taking me out to the backyard one clear night, and we watched Sputnik overhead. And, you know, the Soviets were the first to put a satellite in space, first to put a human in space. And the only reason why we got to the moon first was because a guy named John Fitzgerald Kennedy decided that he was going to marshal all the elements of American power to make sure that we got there. That's what we need, a space race type effort at this particular time in technologies, 5G, quantum computing, quantum communications, and, of course, artificial intelligence.
Let me ask you finally about another development with respect to the militarization of some of these man-made islands the Chinese have created in the South China Sea. The Spratlys, I'm told, two of their installations there are now installing sophisticated jamming equipment, which could be a further intensification of their ability to both defend those facilities and also exercise control over the adjacent waters. Your thoughts on that development and what we should be thinking and seeing and doing about it?
Yes, that jamming equipment, as you mentioned, is going into the Spratlys, which is the archipelago in the southern portion of the South China Sea. Also, it's going on Mischief Reef, which is very close to the Philippines. You know, we're going to have a new head of Pacific Command, and that is going to be the number one challenge, not climate change, as a former PACOM commander once said. The thing is, there were rumors that there was going to be an Air Force general heading PACOM. Apparently, it's going to be an admiral. The Navy has had some pretty pro-China views, and I do hope that whoever is the next head of PACOM, whether Navy or not, is going to be able to speak forthrightly on this. And the one thing that whatever one thinks about President Trump, he defends the U.S. He does not believe that supporting China's Communist Party is a goal of American foreign policy.
As you know, you were there at CPAC when I said it. I think we were actually at war with them. It's an undeclared and thus far not so much military confrontation, but it's definitely across the board now. Gordon Chang, as always, we appreciate your time and expertise tremendously. Come back to us again next week, and I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.